If you don't know already, you need to go back and listen to section one and section two. In section three of this five-part series, we're going to be exploring pages 92 through 133 of the Bonsai Art of Kimura.
Okay.
The white pine on page 92 and 93. There's a lot of work in here that, again, is just really... really beautiful, really, really beautiful fundamental work.
Yeah.
I find it, so his definition of the line base to tip at the new angle, which obviously he oriented this up and then rotated it clockwise. Yep. He almost virtually stood it up on end and then rotated it sideways. It's unusual to see. If you notice on the hero shot on page 93, the left side of the trunk, you kind of see some very knobby, sharp, weird-looking gins.
Mm-hmm.
He turned that whole left side of the trunk into deadwood. And maybe it is all deadwood, because in page 92, you see all those branches have been cut. But pines don't typically... fully go to deadwood on the trunk. They have lateral transport capacity, and I would almost be willing to bet that this was a choice to create a fully deadwood connected deadwood piece on the left side of that trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if he would have done that later on in his career, because I never saw him do anything like that. I certainly wouldn't want to do it, knowing what I know about pines and what gives them value, and that deadwood doesn't really add a lot of value to that tree.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful little tree. Five-needle pines have wonderful foliage characteristics and qualities. Yeah, pretty nice. Nice little tree, but
it's nice. I kind of like the angle it was originally in. It seems a little bit more dramatic.
Yeah, possibly.
And keeping the...
Look at the base that he's got on it.
Yeah.
Though.
I know, yeah, because, well, it has the... That straight.
I mean, you're playing on cut branches as giving it the girth in the original photograph.
Yeah.
But that's not the real base of the tree. He probably started repotting it and found that the base was in an entirely different location. And that, you know, you think, he's looking at this on page 92, and then he made all the choices for 93.
Yeah.
But who's to say he didn't just say, gosh, I don't even know where the base is, and started looking for the base, and that led to what happened on page 93.
Sure.
Because he's dealing with all cut off branches, and just by simply digging in a little bit and figuring out where the base is, all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually, this is far better. You know, it's not like with bonsai, you just make these choices and make the tree do what you want it to do. A lot of design in bonsai is very passively found through just objective discovery of the characteristics of the tree.
Well, and on page 92, you have this real pit. It's like a real peg on the bottom right of the Nabari. So he had to bury that, you know.
But you don't really know, because the tree's been rotated clockwise so much.
Yeah.
So it's tough to say, but I just bring that up just to basically be like, it's not like Mr. Kimura's like, I'm going to change it like this.
Mm-hmm.
It probably was as much a product of just what the tree, when he started repotting it, he was just like, oh, shit, this is, oh, okay, all right, well, let's do this then, you know?
Great white pine, cool lotus container.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the combination of the container.
Because the trunk of the pine is so massive, and then the container is pretty delicate.
No. I think the apex is centered over the base of the tree. You've got equal distance on right and left. So this is probably a first iteration, but it's a very youthful. It looks beautiful. It's not a very engaging or exciting design. But beyond that, the apex being centered over the base and being centered over the container, you don't have a lotus here. What you have is like a mirror-shaped tree. They call this shape arinka.
Okay.
And it's a mirror shape. So the softer form of this would be the floral lobed shape that wouldn't have the points, right? And the points typically, with arinka, the points typically work with a thicker trunk tree and a more masculine characteristic, and the full lobes would work with a more feminine, curvaceous, and slender trunk tree. But the apex being so centered over that pot doesn't really, in my mind, work. I think it would actually look better in an oval pot.
Okay.
Yeah. And, huh. and this is just...
With that massive of a trunk, even.
In an oval pot?
Yeah.
Well, what's... Why would you not...
Because Matt, I mean,
okay,
this
put it
looks pretty masculine.
Okay, so put it in a rectangle with rounded corners. Yeah, but I think, yeah. And this is just understanding of container dynamics and how that symmetrical and centered of a design over essentially a manipulation of the round form, and the round form really proving to work better when the apex breaks the lateral boundary. Mm-hmm. If you know that, it's not even so much like believing it. But if you put an oval underneath this tree, I bet it would look better.
Sure.
Or if you put a soft cornered rectangle under it, I bet it would look better.
Yep.
Does it speak to my immaturity that I really like the little look of it?
No, I mean, because it looks nice.
It does look nice. It's a really cool tree.
And it's not a discussion of immaturity. I mean, you could put it in a lotus and it would look quite nice too. I think all I'm saying is, when you look at these things and it looks quite nice, is it still the best iteration of the tree? My response would be no. It's not the best iteration of the tree. It's an iteration of the tree. Are there levels that could be improved? Sure. Are there pots that we put trees in at Mirai that we don't come back and change the pot 3 or 4 years later as we learn, as that pot comes in, as the design advances? This is commonplace because your first iteration, this is a first iteration on this tree. This is from February 1983 to August 1984. This is 1 year.
Yep.
Wow.
I mean, the ability for this tree to evolve and change over 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years. I mean, it's gonna have so many milestones in its evolution that this is just one take. Maybe that's what he had. Maybe that's what he thought looked good, and it would continue to shift. You know, this is the whole concept of, in the danger. This is the danger of putting something in print.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a static.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we created Mirai Live, because we can continue to evolve that and then use that dialogue of the evolution as a way to help people understand the process better.
Yeah.
All we had was this, and this is what created the print model is what created the rules of bonsai.
Mm-hmm.
We're interpreting a static lack of evolution, a non-dynamic media source for education to this point in our bonsai careers. Look at how fast information is evolving bonsai around the world right now, because it's dynamic.
Yeah.
And you can see the process and you can go back and readdress these things. You would have to make another book.
Sure.
To show this again. That's a huge expense, huge cost. These trees don't exist in his garden anymore. It just is what it is.
Yep. And also, look at how nicely he camouflages the cut scar of the removal of the former number one branch. Do you see that? You can just see it peeking out from the left side of the number one in the finished hero shot.
What?
So, okay. There's a number one branch on page 92. You see it? It's long. Mm-hmm. It sort of bends up.
Mm-hmm.
That branch was removed.
I don't think it was removed.
Oh, well, look at how big it is.
That looks like the apex. No.
No, because where the big branch that moves to the right and the big branch that moves to the left on page 92, the big branch that moves to the left forms the apex. The big branch that moves to the right forms the defining branch on the hero tree. Because you can look right above the rounded pad of the defining branch, and you can see the fork that exists there and the structure that creates that. So it's still the same.
I think he removed it, and he pulled a lighter branch in, and I think he used gray cut paste. And I think you're seeing the cut paste right above those needles.
I don't think so. I think the cut paste exists behind that crotch.
That branch is.
Look at the branch, and then as you move down that branch on page 92, the very first junction, very close to the shoulder.
No, right here, this junction.
Look, Will, right here. Right here.
Yeah, yeah.
He probably shortened it, but he definitely is using that as a structural piece. He didn't pull something down from above because there's nothing to pull down from above.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful parting of those two structural pieces right there. Let's go to the black pine on 94.95. This is dope.
Yeah, it is.
This design. This design is dope.
Perfect example again of the branch selection negative space.
But
adding negative space.
But again, the best part of this tree is the use of the branch on the left. Because yeah. Look at where it originates from the trunk. It goes up from the trunk.
Yep.
What an organic use of the tree's natural structure. Oh, this goes up instead of down. I've got to cut it off. I mean, this is where if somebody were abiding by the quote unquote traditional rules,
they would cut that off.
Yeah, if you cut that off, this tree loses a lot.
Yep.
Now you could cut it off, but I'm guessing he kept it because it either disguises something or gives, you know, brings balance to the tree. I mean, you could cut it off and there's not enough visual weight to really make it an unbelievable design. But I think it's such a charming, organic, natural character to have that branch going up and then out to the left. I think that's very cool. I think that there's a lot of merit in that.
It's important to know when to make a vertical, like a sort of a secondary trunk, if you will, in a design to realize when something needs to come up.
But I don't think he used it as a trunk. He clearly used it as a branch. But I think even the way he used it, it doesn't have any verticals in it, right?
He
changes all the lines. It's just a really good use of design.
And what I meant is, as an artist, it's important for me to know when I'm designing a tree, like, not everything has to come down.
Oh, yeah.
It's important to know when to bring something up to give it that next level.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it took me years to understand that I can do that.
Well, the juniper that I'm working on in the studio right now,
downstairs.
A lot of those branches are going to have to come up to fill in. There's no interior ramification on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you lay this out and it's super long. Mm-hmm. Some of those are going to have to come back and build the body in that because there's nothing to build the body in that tree and it needs to be compressed because it's a fairly slender tree.
Mm-hmm.
This is just using the structure that you're given. And most people's concept is, I need it to back bud and then I'm going to grow another branch here and stuff. And it's like, but the natural growth habit of the tree is conducive to this type of branch formation anyways.
Sure.
And it actually, over the course of time, will warrant a much more interesting tree than growing out a bud that you hope exists someday that you can't count on. You know, it's just like...
Take 20 years.
Yeah, or if it ever comes to fruition at all.
Yeah.
Just sitting there looking at the tree, waiting for that bud to grow in that perfect location, or even grafting and trying to create this perfect structure. It's like the imperfection of the structure and the organic nature of the use as it occurs in that species is the more... creative solution regardless. It's going to be the more attractive, interesting solution regardless, I think.
Yeah.
But this is also, there's a lot of people that would think differently of
that. I wish it was in a non-bon kind of little
bit more. Yeah. The
drum.
The drum is also for where you break the plane with the apex.
I think that's the most effective use of the drum personally. Yeah.
Because of that, to show you, because
it adds stability.
It's just so strong, and I mean, you have straight walls, you've got a low seat, you've got a high contact point. I mean, almost the whole pot contacts the surface, except for the cutouts to break the meniscus of the water to allow it to move freely out of the container. So it seems to me it's a pot that offers the stability that warrants a little bit more movement off of the rim, but I'm not at all mad at the use of the drum right there. It seems quite nice.
I mean, look at how awesome that pot is too, by the
way.
Is that a tokonoma, do you think?
It's tough to say because a lot of potters made drums.
Yeah.
And I would say it looks very shoes-on-ish from the texture and the color of the clay, but shoes-on typically made very spiky, pointed nail heads to his drums, and those are very rounded. So who knows? Who knows who made it? You'd have to see the chop to really know.
I really like the tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a cool tree. I think the image in the upper left on page 94
is
much more beautiful than the hero on page 95.
It's filled in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's filled in. The needles are shorter. It's quite nice, quite attractive. The spruce forest.
Picea, God, that's amazing.
Picea glenii. Yeah, this is an
Look
Enzo.
Look at that.
Look at the change in the bow of the trunks from the first planting to the second.
Yeah.
Sort of that initial 1 year later, initial styling. And then also notice the branch reduction and the way that
they shorten the branches too.
You compress them to give it. So shortening the branches gives it a lot more impression of verticality. The reduction of the branches gives it a lot more impression of age. But then the bowing of the trunks outwards is a nice evolution of the design concept.
Really nice. So how do you decide to make your forest straight vertical versus having it bow like this? Is it just...
I feel like the... So let me just digress a little bit and say, I feel like the bow is a little contrived, slightly contrived, but also, bless you, also there's no wire on those trunks. So you notice in the first few iterations, and this is 1984, so this is 3 years after the initial planting, 2 years after the initial styling. Some of that bow may actually be quite organic, which, and it's tough to say if he put the bow in there or if, because spruce will move on their own quite a bit. They're very phototropically driven.
Yeah, they chase the sun.
Huh? Yeah, and there's a lot of inconsistencies in the trunks. If you look just to the front left of the primary trunk in the hero shot on page 96, you see two smaller trunks in the foreground.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see a trunk in the background that crosses over both of them.
Yep.
Right? It's real subtle to see it. But that is just the spruce doing what it's doing. And the fact that these trees don't have wire on them and they're holding that kind of shape and organization is pretty impressive.
It's awesome.
It's pretty impressive. It's a beautiful forest. I find the straighter trunks to be more, it feels to me more representative of spruce. You very rarely do you go into the woods and see like a spruce forest and see the trunks bowing like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, it could be totally organic. He may have implemented that into it. Since the initial shaping in 82, he may have changed that. It's tough to say, but a pretty cool forest. Maybe one of the most important pieces of the forest, although it's a little challenging, is the most slender trunk that fills the negative space in between the two groves in the back. I don't know why it feels so awkward. It feels a little awkward, but also it seems important to give you that depth perspective. It really makes the forest feel...
Gives it depth.
You've got thin trunks in the foreground and a thin trunk in the background. And notice on the grove, in the grove on the left, notice how you don't have that same sensation of depth.
Yep, you don't. It feels more flat.
Feels a little flatter. Yeah, and that's just two-dimensional. I'm sure that those are planted on different planes, but you see the impact of having that really slender trunk in the back. It does give the impression of... sort of disappearing. What do they call that? The vantage point? No, the getting tired. Anyways, that was just a spattering of ramble. You know that the bow trunks themselves give the
composition of the feeling of more depth when you look at the stick straight vertical ones. Feels a little bit more flat in the picture, maybe not in real life, but
yeah.
Okay, moving on.
Yeah, this next juniper, 98 99 100 and 101,
there's our buddy
Mr. Kawabe. This is a unique The hero shot on 101. This is a unique take on juniper. This feels
wild.
Much more. It feels very wild, and it feels a lot like a Western.
What we This is a lot of what we've been doing.
Well, this and sometimes this is a lot of what we see.
Yep.
But also, just take a look at the lower right branch, and notice how he brings a lot of those branches up as if they were secondary apices.
Mm-hmm.
He's filling negative space with those. I don't think he's thinking about those as secondary apices. He's connecting the regions, but he's using a lot of branches vertically in this whole design, mm-hmm. which is not something you commonly see in his approach.
But I mean, look at the dead wood. There's a lot of trunks coming up.
Sure.
Vertically.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's probably reflecting that growth habit.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the white pine on.
That's cool. That's cool. Sort of natural style from Kimura. You don't see that too often from him.
Yeah. This white pine.
Oh, man.
Is a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a monster.
Have you worked with this one?
I have worked with this one. In fact, I wired this tree the year that it won the Kokufu Prize.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and it was really cool. Mainly because so during my apprenticeship I wired 4 trees that won Kokufu prizes. And it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
To say that because all the work's already been done.
Yeah.
The job in wiring a tree that wins a Kokufu prize is to have the least amount of input, use the least amount of wire, manipulate the shape to bring it into that fruition of all of the hands that have touched it to that point. It's a lot of restraint. It's making sure that you're not doing too much to the tree. And there is a lot of skill and technique involved in that, but the tree winning the Kokufu Prize wasn't a result of my wiring. I just didn't screw it up so it didn't win.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Still, I bet it makes you feel a little bit good, right? I mean,
yeah, it's cool.
Like, I had a hand in that.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very well. I think when you see a tree that gets to that level and you recognize how many hands have touched it, then to get to be one pair of hands in that journey of that tree is pretty special.
Yeah,
it is pretty special. But it's when it won the Kokufu Prize, it was in a beautiful round.
So quick tech analysis. Look at, this is an example of where he turned it 180 degrees and made the former back the current front.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Feels like a good decision. Feels like a very good decision. It's a stunning tree. Yeah. I mean, now it looks almost nothing like this.
Really?
No,
yeah,
no, because it's the height of the tree is elevated. There's a lot more root mass showing that's, you know, integrated with moss and has aged over the course of time.
Yeah,
and it's just a wonderfully delicate, beautiful white pine cascade. Yeah, stunning.
Could
tree.
You? How would you Google this tree and see photos of it currently? Is there a way to do that?
Well, I'm trying to think.
Is there a name for it?
I'm trying to think. It would be the Kokufu Prize winning tree in, I can't remember when I was there. I'm trying to think of the Kokufu exhibitions when I was there. I know we hit Kokufu exhibition 80. So it would have been 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, somewhere in that range, the cascading white pine in there. That's the tree, and that's, yeah, I did a lot of work on a lot of Kokufu trees over those periods.
Next up, page 104 and 105, we have a Japanese black pine.
This is pretty stellar work. To find the tree that he found in that this I find this to be quite impressive, because he had to be looking objectively at angles that don't automatically present themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if you notice the root base on the tree that he has, it clearly is a root base that, whether it was the natural root base and somebody changed it to be what it was in the initial tree, which the big sort of bulge sticking out of the soil,
yeah,
on the right and the top image on page 104. And you see the evenly distributed, particularly on page 105, if you look at the lower right image and you see the way that the roots on the back, or you look at the lower left image on 105 and you see the even distribution of the Nabari, and you see the roots. If you look at the hero image on 105, the top image, notice the roots on the right side of the base don't have bark on them because they were buried. And if you look at the lower mm-hmm. left image on 105, you see the roots in the back are all barked up. You see the roots in the front are kind of a reddish tint,
yep,
because they were underneath the soil.
Yep.
That's a major sort of clue as to what happened. He picked that up and those roots were there. So that was probably actually the original position of the tree. Somebody planted it at a different angle and raised the roots up out, and that formed that ugly bulge. And then he just kind of took it back probably to what it originally was sort of intended to be.
Yeah. Great, great tree.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting on page 107 to see the image of that with just sort of needles everywhere. And it looks as though the tree maybe, so that's 1984. Mm-hmm. Let me see when the styling was, 1983. So it's possible that there was some severity to the repot, and you can see the tree has a lot of older needles that are quite long, and there's not a lot of needles on the new shoots. May have been quite a severe repot to get it to that point, and he's leaving the longer, older needles on to get this tree back strong to strength and health,
yeah,
because you can see just how little the growth pushed out, whether they decandled it and it pushed out or whether they didn't decandle and it was just super weak. So they're definitely allowing strength to reaccumulate in the tree. But it also looks like, if you look at page 106, it also looks like the tree was quite unhealthy.
Yeah, see, look at that color.
Like suffering,
yeah,
hard.
Yeah, so it's just a rebuilding of the tree's energy and strength.
Huh.
Yeah, quite beautiful.
Page 108
and 109, I think.
God, look at that.
So I think this tree went to Europe, and I feel like I saw long ago when Marco Invernizzi was really doing a lot of work in Europe, I feel like this may be a tree that to some degree had some, if it's the same tree, and I could be wrong, but I feel like this tree may have been sent to Europe, exported to Europe, and I feel like Marco may have adjusted this or done some design evolution on this tree. And again, I could be wrong. I'm just trying to function from memory, and that's a lot of bonsai images in my head. But yeah, this is a beautiful tree. And quiet, stately.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Really interesting. Lots of character, lots of dead wood.
Yeah, yeah. Not a particularly textured dead wood. It's very, very smooth, kind of younger deadwood, but the shape of this is extremely pleasing, particularly page 108, the smaller picture up top, where it's on a lighter background and you can kind of get the full breadth of the spacing between the branches without the dark gradation behind it. It is quite attractive.
I like the shadowing though on this photo.
Mm-hmm.
The lower one.
Yeah, because it shades, frankly, what I think is maybe the least desirable part of the tree, which is sort of that it's almost flat, but that there's kind of a thick piece there that seems like
going to the right.
Yeah, the piece of deadwood going to the right. That, yeah. It's just, I mean, it's not flat, but it's just
a hair above horizontal.
Yeah.
And that used to be, looking at the picture on 109, that used to be the defining branch.
Okay.
Which he clearly eliminated and left the deadwood there. Because if he tried to take the deadwood off, you run the risk of creating a little bit of thinness in the trunk. Maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very, cool. very pleasing. Very stately tree.
It's really cool. Moving on.
Taxus.
Kind of exciting to see something go from that to that.
This is notice how he hollowed the Taxus out and create. I mean, Taxus rots from the inside out. Their deadwood is known for its hollows. That's pretty. That carving and the approach to it feels very fitting for a Taxus. Feels very on point.
Yeah.
For a Taxus. Yeah, and I'm sure. I feel like I've seen this tree, but I can't be sure. But this feels like very good work, and obviously it's such a underdeveloped tree. I'm sure this became something quite spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how he used the natural deadwood that exists in the upper portion of the tree on page 111, and you look at how he handled the deadwood. It's very, very beautiful handling of the deadwood and preservation of that natural character, integration of the living tissue that he turned to dead with the older deadwood.
And a large reduction of the deadwood up there, you
mm-hmm.
know.
He
took a lot of it off and
removed the mass.
Kept the height, but gave the tree way more taper.
Yep. Yeah, he was such a pioneer.
He's the pioneer of handling
deadwood. He was such a pioneer of handling that deadwood, and he did so very, very well.
Page 112, 113.
Oof. What a dangerous reduction of a needle juniper. I mean, that is dangerous right there, to reduce a needle juniper so heavily in one go.
Doesn't say the year of the original either, does it?
1 year reshaping collected from nature. This is when it was collected. 1 year later, 84. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty sort of one go kind of reduction. Yeah. It looks like, but you see it in July 10th. Cool. It's producing new growth. Balance of water and oxygen. If you can water correctly, you can get away with a lot in bonsai, but I'm assuming this took such on point watering because you're removing all of the water movement with that kind of foliar reduction and really balancing the water well, to do that and to get away with that. But a very dramatic
compaction,
very dramatic. Compaction. Yeah. And it brings all of the focus down to that strong trunk, which is quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see where it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to see this tree as well.
Reminds me kind of like of a conch shell. A little bit.
I don't see that, but all right.
114, 115, yeah. This black pine. This pine always intrigued me so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rock in a pot. Look at that.
Yeah, it intrigues me because he added the stone on the backside of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes all the difference in the world for the composition. I would love to see what that looks like on the backside of the tree. How did he add it? Because there's a stone on the front right of the tree. Naturally, it's very reddish colored, and you can see it looks a little bit more gray. My guess is that he took out the old reddish stone that doesn't have all the contour, mm-hmm. and that he put in, and maybe that stone wrapped around the back of the tree, and he put in an Abigawa stone.
Yeah,
that's a lot more jagged.
Way more character.
Notice the sort of accent pieces that are planted between the trunk and the stone on page 115. It seems as though that's probably a disguise for potentially where the new stone that was added and the old stone was removed. The new stone that was added, probably he's meshing those gaps right there, which is a beautiful use of an organic, very organic way to hide those spaces.
Yeah, with the sedum.
It's not sedum. It's a Japanese form of a really succulent. I used to have some of this, and It just sort of dwindled away in the Kusumono pot that I had it. But it is a very succulent kind of green leafy. And I feel like it's almost like a fern.
Huh.
Because it produces spores on the underside of the leaf, if I'm thinking correctly. Yeah, but that this tree, particularly in the upper right portion where it's in the Rinka pot.
Yeah, that's... I like that
conversation. I really, really enjoy that in the Rinka pot. It's probably...
The one from 83?
Yeah, the one from 83. Maybe he felt like it was a little bit feminine for such a masculine pine. That pot's reduction of size definitely makes the trunk look more powerful mm-hmm. than the drum pot that he has it in in 84. But nevertheless, very, very... Very, very powerful tree. And awesome. And an interesting use of stone, an added mm-hmm. stone nonetheless.
How the dickens is that even?
Whoa. So are we on to 116, 117?
Yep, let's keep going.
And I wonder here if he grafted roots to this or if he did the deadwood reduction with the coiling. Just judging on the size of the container that slender trunk is hanging out of, I'm guessing that he removed the deadwood and coiled the live vein up in there, and he needed that large of a pot to have the space to put the coiled live vein in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it seems like he may have used a smaller pot if it was a root graft.
Sure.
Of course, it is a very vertically long tree, so maybe he needed that weight of that pot or that size to hold that vertical drop.
Yeah, the pot seems a little big for that narrow of a... I mean, there's no Nabari.
Yeah, well, and that's either a root graft, or I'm guessing that was a root coil
mm-hmm.
that he probably utilized to execute that. Creative. I mean, he definitely brought the attention up to all of the deadwood movement at the top of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, notice all the juvenile foliage on it.
Uh-huh.
Just a chinensis that's getting its feet underneath it and
mm-hmm.
sort of oscillating between mature and not. Page 118, 119, again, they call this a taxus, and this is definitely a kimitsuga. This is definitely a hemlock. And fascinating to see the use of hemlock here. Mr. Kimura doesn't have a lot of hemlock in his garden. The temperatures when he back in the 80s in Tokyo, it was cold. They got a lot more snow. They still get snow, but not as much from what I was told as they did earlier on. And now it's almost impossible for him to cultivate kimitsuga over the course of a prolonged period of time just because it's too warm. And even spruce is a challenge around Tokyo. Mr. Kimura has really sound horticulture, so he can make that happen. But it has gotten warmer for sure.
And tell me about hemlock. It doesn't like, if it's too snowy, a hemlock won't grow or?
No. At this point, there's a lot of snow and it's much colder and hemlock.
Hemlock does like that.
Yeah. Okay. It needs dormancy. It needs cold.
Yeah, I really don't know anything about hemlock. I've no experience with them.
Yeah, most of them, I'm assuming, come from either the northern part of Honshu, the main island, or potentially and probably more likely Hokkaido, but I don't know that for sure. I don't necessarily know the region where the hemlock are collected. There have been a few really impressive kimitsuga that were shown in the Kokufu. There was a monstrous one that I have a picture of myself sitting underneath.
Yeah.
That was the article for a Kimbone photo shoot at Mr. Kimura's. And the kimitsuga came to us. He did the restyling. We repotted it. We held it until the growth had hardened off the following spring. And then it left because he was nervous about the summertime. So, you know, and he's, again, going from experience. And clearly in this book, this is the third kimitsuga that we've seen, even though they're all called taxus. They're
mm-hmm.
definitely not. So, you know, and he didn't deal with larch at all. And you don't see larch in the Kokufu. You don't see that. Yeah, which I...
They don't have them in Japan?
No, they do.
They do?
Yeah, Japanese larch.
Yeah, that's
Larix
right.
Larix camphora, yeah.
So, huh.
But whether it's sort of out of vogue or there's not great larch or
there might not be good stock. Like,
sure, yeah, the Kamitsuga. There's some really impressive Kamitsuga though.
This is a nice tree. I really like the what he did with it. It's he went with the natural style. I mean, he.
Yeah. Yeah, wonderful handling. The Japanese hemlock has a very small foliage, very small, tight, delicate foliage, more delicate than our mountain hemlock for sure. Very soft, almost more like a Western hemlock than a mountain hemlock, but a smaller proportion to the needle length than a Western hemlock. And the photo angle is kind of interesting. You're looking up underneath the stand.
Mm-hmm.
You're not seeing the base of the tree at all.
No, and it seems like the nabari on this tree is the weakness because you can see it sort of narrows down. At least it looks like it does from this. So
sure.
That might be why we're looking up into it.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful, beautiful use of what the tree has to offer, though. This tree.
Wow.
The juniper on 120, 121. This tree, I did get to see this tree after it has evolved. And I mean, you, unless you just sort of identified the carving on the trunk and the movement in it, you would never be able to tell the two.
Yeah.
As the same thing, this picture to what it looks like now. I mean, where the deadwood is on the upper portion of this tree in the hero shot on page 121,
mm-hmm.
That's all foliage mass, big huge dome canopy. The trunk looks not small for the tree now, but looks a lot more proportional.
Sure.
I mean, here there's no foliage whatsoever.
This is right after,
and so you get to see that evolution of this very underdeveloped, and that's seeing it and then knowing the tree from the book. It was just like, oh, wow.
Wow.
This is what time can do. Because I was at Mr. Kimura's from 2004 to 2010. So that still is, that's 10 years, that's over 10 years ago. I saw this tree at the very end. So it was 2019, 2010. So I saw this, came into the garden. Actually, I saw a picture of this tree the other day on Facebook. It's still in his garden, at least when that picture was taken, it was. And, so you're looking at basically 20 years.
Notice what he did here with that bulge. He made that bulge on page 122.
The base.
Turned it into the nabari.
Turned it into the base, yep, and used the
buried that surprise.
You used the widest point. I mean, this is, people talk about how to handle inverse taper on 122.
Yep.
That's how you handle inverse taper.
Uh-huh.
Change the planting angle to use the widest point of the inversion if it's low enough close to the soil line as the new base and reconceptualize that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
carved a lot of relief into that deadwood. Look at between the light and the dark in the deadwood. That thing has some canyons in there to give it depth.
Yep.
We got to start carving lots of depth into our deadwood. This is what I'm seeing.
I don't know, man. I don't know. When Mr. Kimura was carving back in the day, he created a lot of drama and whatnot, and there is a marketability to that increase from what the raw material was, which is a very low quality raw material. On page 122, that's not an expensive tree, or I wouldn't assume it's an expensive tree. But
piece of landscape stock or something.
But when you see these trees now, that carving, there is a lot of artificiality to it.
Yeah.
And those trees are not as valuable when you're putting them up next to natural trees that have tremendous deadwood. Whether they have more depth or not, because you can still tell that it was artificially created.
Yeah.
As the tastes have evolved, the cream is always going to rise to the top, and the trees that have the natural deadwood are going to usurp that. Now, you could look at this and say, well, that tree as raw material never would have had any value, period, had he not carved it. And so inside of that, yes, there is an evolution there, and that was the appropriate thing to do, and it added a tremendous amount of quality. So this is making lemonade out of lemons again. He's maximizing the material, But still, the superior material is going to be the natural deadwood. Every time.
Interesting. That's, man, good. This is good. 124, 125. Wow. Love this.
Yeah. This is.
Talk about, you know, a forest that giving a forest with this radial, kind of like the, how they bowed out the, that last forest we talked about. This uses more of an extreme, angle on some of these trunks, but it's following the natural Yamadori that this thing was collected or grown with. You know, it already had those angles, but the pads of foliage being so horizontal, like this thing is just beautiful. Having, look at all these perfect pads in there, and then with these radially, it's a raft, right? Is that
the, it is a raft.
This is a raft.
Yeah, it is a raft. And the description says there's too many trunks. There's never too many trunks in a raft.
Yeah.
I think the problem, in probably my assumption, is that the raft in picture 124 has symmetry.
Yeah.
The same length from the dominant trunks to the right and to the left exist. And so he basically removed the right side.
Yeah, he left stumps.
And utilized the left side. Maybe there was more diversity of trunk size and spacing. And maybe there was a higher quality. Who knows? Who knows what his decision-making was in trying to reduce it that much. But he definitely gave it a lot more asymmetry. It's also interesting to look at the angles that he gives the branches and the styling on page 125, because you've got this sort of clump style or connected root raft style, and these are moving up and out. You can really see the up-out movement, which typically pines have a downward movement. And had he brought downward movement to everything, it wouldn't have necessarily worked in this raft style tree, because all the branches would be crashing into each other and it would be hard to give the impression of that movement to the left that he's given, that where they're moving up and out and he's actually bringing things up and out. And he was very, very in tune with how to execute these different environmental insinuations.
Yeah.
And that's very, very special part of his work. Even in this delicate design with these slender trunks, he's picking out those nuances and executing them in different ways. And I don't know that people appreciate that aspect of his like artistic sensitivity from that perspective, but it is a beautiful part of the diversity of his capacity and approach.
Seems like there could have been some opportunities for dead wood on the right side. Is it because that it's a pine forest that you don't leave some of those trunks as standing dead?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I don't think deadwood is the valuable part of most pines as it comes to Japanese pines. I mean, we have a lot of deadwood on our ponderosas and limbers, and there's a lot of deadwood on the Scots and Mugos in Europe. Deadwood on pines in Japan. I mean, it's a part of some trees. Maybe artificially creating it didn't feel authentic to him. Maybe.
Sure.
Maybe rot and deterioration. Who knows? Who knows why he chose to not do that? But
I mean, if you look at 124, I mean, there's some pretty substantial trunks that are over there that could have been. But hey, he's making a composition that definitely moves left.
Yeah.
So
definitely moves left, and also can go into a significantly reduced container, half the size.
Yep.
With that commitment that he's made. And also
the beautiful
small little trunk to the back on the lower right.
Yeah, that's nice.
That is pretty trick. Pretty trick little piece to have hanging out over there.
Okay, we are getting towards dinner. page 126 and 127. Here we get a little bit more vision into the process, using a piece of rebar as a lever. Look at his pants. like that's this is some late 70s, early 80s. You can tell just by the pants he's wearing.
Yeah, you can see Yajima-san on page 127 in the upper left. He's the apprentice holding the pot.
Uh-huh.
But you can see all three apprentices in that picture.
Cranking on that
thing. Cranking on it with a big piece of rebar. Taxis, super duper hardwood.
Yeah.
Really flexible. I mean, they made longbows out of right? So it has a lot of flex to it. So really cranking down that height because you've got this big massive base and you say, when do you compress? When do you lower the height of the trunk or lower the height of the tree? You do so when you're trying to reduce that vertical height to increase the lateral proportion of the trunk. And so when you look at page 126 in the upper left, you see how high and slender that apex is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see what the compression does, particularly in the center two photos where you're looking at the back in the upper photo and you see how high it is and then you see what the compression did and how big the trunk appears in the lower piece after it's been repotted and all of that's been brought to fruition. So when you look at 128 and 129, you really get that power of that tree with that compression. The trunk grows in size exponentially when you reduce that height, that verticality and that height.
Oh, wow, look at that.
I've always loved this tree. I think this is a very impressive tree. I've never seen it in person.
Now, the live vein, page 129, the live vein seems awfully straight. Wouldn't he, I guess there's nothing he can do, or wouldn't he, whereas 128, the live vein is a little bit more minimized.
Yeah, I mean, he pushed the deadwood out, gained girth in the base, brought out a lot more movement in the deadwood, brought out the hollow characteristic that already naturally existed. You get the live vein. I mean, what can you do? I mean, it's minimized and you lose a lot of quality. You maximize the quality and you have a straight live vein. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Live vein straight. When you look at any of the other photos, there's no area in this where the live vein has a tremendous amount of movement.
Yeah, that's right.
And when you look at the backside on 126 in the middle photograph, you look at the backside, the deadwood there's not a lot of interest there. So I still think it seems to me the decision was yeah. natural. It's yep. just maximizing what the material is giving you.
Exactly.
Now, page 130 and 131, this is my most favorite tree in the book.
Ooh.
Hands down. I love the pot. I love the tree.
Yeah.
And his change to the design is monumental.
Really?
To move it from a tree that has all of the foliage mass on the left side of the tree, and to be able to transition that branch that's on the lower left in page 130, and then you see in 131, he transitions it to the right, and it's got deadwood all along it. And I've looked at this a lot. I still don't quite understand all of the moves that he made. He rotated the tree a little bit clockwise to be able to close down the negative space that exists on the right side of the base on page 130. You can see in 131, there's not a lot of negative space where that ribbon of deadwood comes up. But just the way the live veins interact and the spaces and the delicacy. Now, this is a bigger tree. 38 inches, you're almost at 40 inches of height.
Yeah, that's huge.
It's a big tree. It's not a small tree. I've seen this tree. There's a picture. It might be in this book or in one of his other books where he's in the garden with one of his clients. And I don't know where that picture is. But you see this tree in the background, and it's a picture with a client, and it's for another tree. And a discussion, I don't know where I've seen it, but it's big. It's a big tree.
Have you worked on this?
No, I've never seen it in person. But here's the other really brilliant thing that happens. In page 130, notice the gin that's moving vertically up in the tree.
Uh-huh.
And on page 131, that gin that is moving vertically up in the tree right there has been folded over. and is the djinn that's pointing down and to the right. Notice the loop of deadwood, and it's pointing down to the right. So whether he steam bent that, or I don't know how he brought about that bend and change in that deadwood, that's a pivotal part of the design to have that djinn over there. Because if you just had that long, slender branch on the right side, you would notice how slender that line was, and there's so much negative space around it, and there's no foliage mass on the portions of that branch closer to the trunk. That djinn being bent and brought over to add more visual, visual positive mass and filling that negative space with an element besides that really slender branch that gives movement to the right on page 131 was a brilliant knowledge of aesthetics to accomplish that. And
Rye,
then,
Rye, I think, take a look. Here's some. I'm taking a look at that vertical djinn in page 131. It has a little horn just below the top of it. Do you see that?
Oh, yeah. So it's the same one.
Page 130, yeah, so it's you can the same see one. That horn. It's just slightly rotated.
You are correct. So, so then that had to have come
it
from...
It might be a back djinn in page 130.
Not a back djinn. See how there's all that plethora of djinns loops. Sort of broken up? It's one of those.
Yeah.
And it looks to me like if you look at 131, you see the reddish hue on the bottom of it. It looks like he split that off of something. And separated some deadwood somewhere. So it already had that downward orientation, and he must have rotated it off of something. Regardless, it's a brilliant cool. touch point. And the way that he's reduced the size. Notice how small the apex is in 131 compared to the size of the apex in 130.
Yeah. The apex in 130 is too heavy.
He's really feminized the canopy of the tree.
Yep.
Just everything about it. I mean, I think this is such a stunning, stunning creation here and stunning advancement of the design.
Do you think, is this tree still around?
I think it probably is somewhere. I mean, a lot of trees exist in the backyards of collectors and, you know, pop out every once in a while. I mean, even now, trees that have never been seen are still shown. Yeah. It's like, you just don't know. You just have no clue where these trees are, where they exist. It's phenomenal. The bonsai quantity of quality in Japan is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to see this tree. I would love to see this tree in person. Yeah. This is tops for me though in the book. I just think the way that he handled every aspect of this tree is so intelligent. The container is one of my most favorite containers ever.
Looks antique.
Yeah, it's antique. It's a stunning container. The color of the clay, the formation, the presence of the copious quantity of feet, which is kind of abnormal, makes it very unique. I think this is just an absolutely brilliant handling.
Large negative space between the foliage pads, elegant, tall, slender, feminine form, that the height is increased by that tall djinn at the top. Yeah, this thing is...
But look at how tall the djinn gets and how much he compressed
the
space to work
with.
You can
see the guy wire that he used to
And he pulled it. He pulled the apex to the right to work with the branch that he shifted to the right. It's just... Yeah, that's such a beautiful handling of the material.
Okay.
132, Ezo. And I mean, this is all about the handling of the deadwood.
Look
now,
at the carving, yeah.
When he would handle spruce, he was happy to leave a lot cruder, rougher deadwood because spruce typically don't have the same refined deadwood as junipers. You can see a lot of the grit on it. You can see some of the tool marks. And
you can see some fuzz even.
There's a spruce that was done for a Bonsai Focus photo shoot that has a djinn created on it. And he did it all with chainsaws, and he didn't come back and refine it. He just left it as a chainsaw. Yeah, and Luis Vallejo at the Alcobendas Museum outside of Madrid, Spain, bought the tree, and the tree's been exhibited multiple times. It's been in magazines a lot, and the djinn is still just a chainsaw created djinn with really crude sort of rough, rugged tool marks on it.
Why? Why did he leave them on there?
Because, well, I mean, I'm only hypothesizing, right? But he used to always say, look, spruce doesn't have the kind of refined deadwood as junipers do.
Yeah.
And so the ruggedness and the sharpness, they're not sandblasted. They're not round and smooth. When they have deadwood, it's typically very
jagged.
Sharp and jagged. Yeah. And that was the character that he chose to create. And I guess he felt good about
yeah.
you know, what he created and how he created it. And so it still exists like that today. I just saw it recently. I believe it was on display at the trophy, because Luis Vallejo had sort of a section not in the judging portion of the trophy of just a collection of his trees. And it was there, and getting to see it, it was a great photo shoot for Bonsai Focus. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, and Mario Comstad doing the curation at the Alcobendas Museum is so talented. I don't think Mario gets enough credit for the skills that he has, but I mean, all of the trees at the Alcobendas Museum are handled just incredibly well. Really beautiful, that spruce.
What town is it in?
Madrid.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. Couple of thoughts on this spruce. The gin at the bottom touching the rim of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Is it better to leave stuff like that with a small gap?
I mean, I don't have a feeling either way. If it touches, it touches. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Too many people put focus on can't touch the pot.
No, so, yeah, it doesn't matter. Wow. Like, we hang gins off the pots totally. All the time.
And why couldn't it touch the pot?
Yeah. Gives a little more stability, probably.